Ladies and gentlemen, you are listening to Zuma JD interview number 3. I'm your host, Zuma JD. This is where we talk with the brightest minds in crypto. We've interviewed Loomdot. We've interviewed Hasu. And today we are talking to Mike Van Rossum. He's the creator of open source bot platform Gecko, founder of market making firm Folkvang. This is going to be a hell of an interview. Mike, welcome to the show.
Awesome, thanks for having me.
This is an interview I was looking forward to very much. I've been on holiday for the past 2 weeks, so wasn't able to find the time to record and get back to my mic, actually. But now that I'm back home, we're good to go, so I'm very happy to have you on.
I'm excited to be the first one after your holiday.
Nice. We've spoken a lot about your previous venture, Gecko, and I think even though it's no longer maintained by you, at least, I think that's something that a lot of people know about. Often when I talk about you to other people, I will mention Gecko, and quite a lot of people actually know about that. So could you maybe, just for those who are listening who have never heard of Gecko, maybe explain how that came about?
Sure thing. So Gecko ended up being a framework to develop your own trading bots. And it came about a very long time ago when I was still in college and when the biggest exchange was Mt. Gox. Back then, I was very interested in trading as well as programming. I couldn't really do either of those things, but I really wanted to learn. And what I figured out over time is that doing open source coding and contributing and doing things in an open and collaborative way with other people, it, for me, is a great way to learn.
Yeah.
And it also keeps it fun. So they say there's a lot of recognition in that. You learn quickly from really smart people. So that's how Gecko started when I was in college, as a tiny little a script. At the time, it wasn't an advanced framework that it later grew into. At the time, it was a very simple script that allows you to watch two AMA crossover lines. So for many of you who are familiar with day trading, you usually use a lot of technical indicators, and EMA is a very standard, simple one. EMA meaning exponential moving average.
Yeah.
So these are basically like average lines that you can plot over the price. And if you have two of those, one being a little bit smoother than the other one, then you can basically like watch when they cross and use that as a signal to identify the start of a trend. Mm-hmm. The idea here is that like if the trend is up, then it's very likely that in the future the price will be higher than now.
Right.
So you should buy now so that you can sell later in the future when it stops going up. That's the goal, yeah. So at the time, it was very little script. That was the only thing you could do with it. When I originally made it, I think this is early 2013.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow, that early.
So this is before Mt. Gox even imploded. Like, it was quite stable back then.
So just out of curiosity, so it was open source from day one. And what exchanges at the time did it integrate with? Or did it not even have an integration ready? It was just a script for, like, you had to plug your own data in or something like that.
No, the first version was only for Mt. Gox.
Okay.
So it was open source from day one.
Hmm.
But the first version, I do actually have to pull up a lot of memories here. But if I remember correctly, how I should have done it and how I think I did it is that the first version didn't do live trading. So it would just spit out messages saying, now we're going into an uptrend.
Like
you should buy.
Like a signal bot or something.
Exactly. It might have had some paper trading in there. So it would calculate like when you start it, it would start with 1,000 virtual dollars, and it would then calculate out based on these signals and based on the price what would have happened. So that's called paper trading.
Yeah.
It went live with that, I think, yeah.
One of the reasons that you decided to do it this way was that by working on an open source project, that's a great way to learn because, you know, you can collaborate easily with other people and learn from other people. Were there other people contributing to the project from the beginning? Or did it take a while? Was it just you for quite a long time before other people started chipping in code or trying to help?
People chipped in relatively from the beginning. So I was very active at that time on Bitcoin Talk, which is a very big Bitcoin community.
Classic.
So all kinds of projects were posted there. So in the, I think in the trading discussion subforum, I posted my project, and that draw all the attention. So all the attention in the beginning came from there. But it took a while. It took quite a long time, many, many months, probably close to half a year before there were actually like active contributors, like people who committed code more than once. But ever since the beginning, there were people like, you know, fixing my spelling mistakes because I'm not a native English speaker. Right. And at the time, I wasn't very good at it. So there were loads of errors, typos, those things. Yeah, it was really cool to see that even from the beginning, because I was also new to open source, or relatively new to open source.
Yeah, that's really cool. When I first got into Bitcoin myself, I was teaching myself how to do web development. Like, I kind of followed a few projects on GitHub and learned how all that kind of stuff works. It's amazing how many people are out there who are willing to help you learn things if you're willing to put in the time and effort. It wasn't just an open source project. Eventually, you went on to build a marketplace, right, where people could buy and sell the bots they'd made using Gecko. Is that correct?
Basically, yeah. Like the algorithms they would make for Gecko, yeah.
How did that come about? Like, what made you think of doing that? And was that your first kind of business venture?
Yeah, I think so. So even in college, I do have to say I was always interested in the startups. So I always had the idea of like creating my own startup. I tried a bunch of projects in college that might blossom into a company, but never really happened. Mm. So I always stayed quite far away. So Gecko Plus, the commercial version of Gecko where that has this marketplace, was my first kind of like an actual company, an actual strategy behind an actual budget and all these kind of things. And not just me developing some software, which later ends up on GitHub.
And then how did you find that? It's a very tough thing to do a business. You have to do so many different things. I'm not saying it's easy to run an open source project, especially one that became as successful as yours did. But obviously running a business is a whole nother kettle of fish, right?
Exactly. And I also figured out that the overlap between the business and the open source project that wasn't as big as I hoped for. So actually the reason why I at some point wanted to turn Gecko into a more a commercial solution is because, or have that besides the open source project, it is because Bitcoin at some point caught the world by storm. So late 2017, the price went very high. It was in the news. Everyone was talking about it, and that was when Gecko became very, very popular. And that's also when I saw the opportunity to do this kind of stuff full time. And I'm like, well, I need to get paid, because right. If you do open source, there's not much. Usually, it's a pretty big big problem in the industry.
Yeah.
Even if you look at like Bitcoin Core development as such, like usually it's a few companies who are dedicating a few engineers, but like because it's the only way. As an open source engineer, you're like you don't really get paid by anyone. So that got me thinking. Like, okay, like if I want to keep working on Gecko, the open source project, like. How am I going to make this sustainable? On top of the fact that many people were starting to reach out that were not technical. So the Gecko project on GitHub is like,
right?
I wrote all the code. So it's not really that you have to do very much because you can just download the code, but it's still a very technical tool. So like it's mainly a command line tool. The idea is that you start working on your own algorithms. And that's a very technical process.
Right. So there's a bit of a barrier there, barrier to entry, which makes things easier because you're not going to have people who don't know what they're doing getting in. Whereas if you're offering a marketplace, people might hear, oh, you know, you can make money with these bots, and then they just want you to handhold them through the whole process. So ultimately, you decided to not continue with that business. However, these days, there's a number of bot platforms out there. I've been looking into a few recently, like Three Commas. Stacked Invest is a more recent one. What's the one named after a rabbit or something? What are some other bot platforms that are around now that you think are quite good or have built on, like Gecko kind of pioneered this, I think, this space?
Yeah, I do have to say, like even when I started working on Gecko, like there were a few software projects or commercial ones as well. That always had a kind of overlap. Like there are many, many online, you can find many comparisons between Gecko and, for example, Haas Online. That's probably the rabbit thing you were referring
to. That was
the
one I was thinking of. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That's actually also a Dutch, that's a Dutch project too, actually. So that actually is really old. That's actually, that might have been from 2013 as well. Like around the same time as Gecko, I think. To be honest, I don't really watch the spades that much anymore. Like, I'm very involved in crypto trading. We'll probably get into that later.
Yeah.
And I do that day to day, 7 days a week. But in terms of retail solutions and consumer products, I actually don't really know what's happening anymore. And that also has to do a little bit with why I quit the project. At the end of the day, it turns out that for trading bots and commercial trading software, a lot of people seem to think that that's like some kind of a golden egg. That can just like, it's a little piece of software that you download or some website somewhere and you press a button and it will just generate money for you. And that's not really how it works, unfortunately.
Yeah, could you go into that a little bit more? Like, why is it more difficult than that? Because it's true, a lot of people really do think about it this way. They think, you know, you find this magic bot and you crack the code and then it'll just print you money forever. My guess would be that actually you constantly have to keep tweaking things to stay competitive.
That's definitely what I notice with the type of trading I do now. The type of trading I do now is very different from the type of trading that you would do with Gecko. Mm. And that also has to do with, the trading I do now is a lot more competitive. If everyone does the same thing, not everyone's going to make the same amount of money. Right. I do a lot of arbitrage right now, for example. And that just means in arbitrage, there's a fixed amount of profit to be made because of some price inefficiency somewhere.
Yeah.
And once that's exploited, or that once that amount of money that there is to be made is made, then the price is even and there is no opportunity anymore. So if many people try it, then only one is kind of going to get it, or you know, a few. And that's the type of trading I do now, and it doesn't really lend itself well to open source, as you can see, because if it was open source and everyone would run it, and yeah, then it wouldn't really work for anyone.
Makes
but
sense.
This is different with Gecko. Yeah. Mm. This is different with the type of trading that you could kind of do with Gecko. So going back into that, I do. So that's more directional trading. So with Gecko, you try to build algorithms that have a sense of the price. Like, you know, we think it's very likely price is going to go up. And as such, we're going to position ourselves in a specific way in the market. So that's one, that's a very hard problem. And two, that also definitely requires constant tweaking because the market, the dynamics keep on changing. So yeah, you're 100% right. Like there is no, or at least I am not aware of any magic box that just keeps on making money.
Yeah.
I'm looking for it. Don't get me wrong.
I think a lot of people are looking for it. Could the Gecko software be used for other markets outside of crypto? Could it be used for like Forex or stocks?
Yeah, actually. So how Gecko works, it's a very modular architecture. So these are called exchange adapters, and you're able to just plug it. Like if you have a little piece of connector code that talks to some other API that's not a crypto exchange, then it should kind of work. With Gecko, by the way, Gecko is definitely styled towards the how the crypto markets used to be, which is mainly spot, for example. So yeah. If you want to do some fancy derivative trading on Wall Street, that's not really going to work.
Right.
Probably you'd have to then make sure you implement all the pricing logic and the margin logic and everything. Yeah, people have done it. They've emailed me about it and they've told me that it works. Or just sometimes they ask me questions about like, how do I plug this properly into Gecko? Yeah, people are doing that actually. And as far as I understand, like I'm still in contact with a few people who have been doing that for years. And as far as I understand, they're still running it and they're really liking it. Yeah.
Interesting. So why did you personally decide to focus on crypto markets rather than going and trading stocks or Forex, which I know can be popular for people who like doing automated trading?
Yes, that's a very good point. Yeah, that is. It's probably way bigger even than equities for sure. There is, by the way, a whole DIY quant movement going on right now. Like you have a lot of like platforms coming out, like Quantopia, for example, that make it very easy for people who study some math and they know a little bit about programming. To just plug into, and I think they focus on stocks, plug into such a market. But yeah, Forex is yeah, you have huge communities of like hackers and quants, and with hackers, I mean like people who just build stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, huge. So yeah, why didn't I? That's a good question. I guess when I started to get interested in this, I also had a very big political leaning. At the time as a very much like a rebel in college.
Right.
And again, this Bitcoin thing was coming out. Yeah, I got super excited in Bitcoin. I wanted to know more about the blockchain stuff. I wanted to know more about the trading as well. In the beginning, I actually focused on blockchain more. Like at some point, I was trying to write a miner, like mining software in WebGL.
Wow.
This is a time when like mining for Bitcoin was still done on GPUs. So when it came out, it was done on like just CPU, so just your processor of your computer.
Yeah.
At some point, it moved to GPUs, graphic cards. After that, was FPGA, and now we have the ASICs.
Ooh, what's FPGA?
Okay, actually, I forgot the abbreviation. It's like Field Programmable Application Controller Interface, something like that. So basically, it's a piece of it's actually super interesting. It's a piece of hardware, like it's a board, a logic board. You can design the circuit after a specific problem or algorithm. So with Bitcoin mining, the problem is that you need to hash, and then hope to find a specific solution. And you can actually, this hashing algorithm that you need to do within Bitcoin mining, you can apply it to a logic board, which is a lot faster than doing it software-wise on a computer.
So what's the difference between that and an ASIC?
So this logic board that they use for FPGA is still a little bit like, it's not designed specifically for whatever, because you can basically like, you can solder the lines yourself on that board, I think. Wow. I might be wrong with the terminology here, but it's still kind of like, you buy the factory makes these boards and then they can be then repurposed on the fly. Whereas an ASIC is very much the same thing, except that in the factory, they were like, no, this board is very specifically only for this hashing algorithm ever. So they've done that in the factory already. And as such, they can lower. So the board is smaller. It has less heat. It loses less heat and the power is more efficient because it only like it's made specifically as small as you need it for Bitcoin mining. Whereas FPGAs are also used for other things. They're also used for trading, by the way.
Wow.
In high frequency trading.
Yeah, it's really interesting. That reminds me of a book I read. Have you read Flash Boys?
Yes.
Yeah, I really, really loved that book. I read it when I was like 15 and decided that I was going to go and try to learn how to do automated trading. But unfortunately, I mean, I think you can do anything if you set your mind to it, of course. But I quickly found out that I don't think that's my strong suit. Best to leave it to people like you, who it clearly is.
It's interesting. Yeah. Because it was, for me, that book was also my inspiration. And I guess I just kept going. I guess I just didn't have many other things to do. Like, it also took me years, right? Like, so if you go back, like 7 or 8 years we're talking now. Yeah, more than seven years now.
This is why I was excited to do this interview with you, because I really like your perseverance. And actually, I think you still have pinned to your Twitter account. You had a tweet you put up where you said something like, you know, trying to figure this out. And then you replied to that tweet when you got funding for your market making firm, saying something like, okay, it looks like I figured it out now, I guess. But it was really, really cool seeing that journey. But it goes to show, if you stick at it and discipline and work hard and thoughtful, you can go very far. Actually, before we get into talking more about your market making operation, I just have one kind of funny question. I really love asking Dutch people this question. Dutch people seem to be overrepresented per capita in the crypto space, especially in terms of early people. Do you agree that, you know, there's a lot of Dutch people like maybe overrepresented per capita? And if so, like why do you think that is?
I definitely think so, yeah. It's a great question. And I think it has a few different answers that all kind of have to do with this. So definitely, generally speaking, Dutch people are very involved in trading. Like a few of the biggest trading firms worldwide, especially so high frequency trading, for example, are Dutch. Even if you go back in time, right, I think like the first stock market was like a Dutch invention to monetize and facilitate like the VOC, which was at the time the biggest company in the world, with its ships going to India and back with spices. Right. So at the time, you could make a bet basically on a boat, on a very specific boat with a captain. That would basically be like the first stock. It would be so you pay some money, you get this little certificate. And the certificate said that if this boat comes back, and the odds were not very, very, very high that was going to happen, because it's a long journey. And they didn't really have much to go off. I think at the time, they didn't have clean water, right? So they brought beer, and that was what they were drinking on the ship and everything. Like it's it was a hard time. So generally speaking, like even traditionally, like we like finance, I guess. But also crypto. Yeah, it's a good question.
I've often heard as well, just in general, when people talk about Dutch people, obviously the Dutch are very famous for being quite a liberal country, quite forward thinking. A lot of people would say the reason for that is that they've got such a long history of being integrated with the rest of the world. It's like a very curious kind of spirit in the country. For the listeners, I've lived in the Netherlands for 1 year and Belgium for 1 year in Flanders, the Dutch-speaking part of Belgium. And it's really interesting how in the Netherlands, the take-up of digital technology, there's so many startups and things like this. But if you go to Belgium, they're a lot slower to adopt a lot of things. So there's like a very clear cultural difference there. It makes it very, very evident.
Generally speaking, I agree with that. Like we're always on the forefront of a lot of technological innovation. The fact that it's also like anti-authoritarian government or like, you know, like or a central bank.
Right.
In a way, like the algorithm behind Bitcoin, right, about how like about the money supply is in a lot of ways a replacement for central bank. And I that's a sentiment that you see in many places in Europe. It's probably heavier in Germany, I think, which also has a pretty big crypto scene.
Yeah.
So that's not specifically Dutch, but generally speaking, you'd see a lot of that as well. Yeah, I need to think on that some more, I think.
Moving on, though, as I was saying earlier, the really interesting thing to talk about is your current business venture, Folkvang, which is kind of recent in the sense that you're really scaling it up now. However, you've been market making for quite a long time now. So maybe tell us a little bit about your journey, you know, moving away from working on Gecko and those types of things and focusing on your market making efforts.
Yeah, for sure. So that all started with... I wouldn't call this a venture. This was definitely like a hobby project called Agent Smith. Agent Smith was, I think I started this early or mid 2017. So it was another piece of software, like a piece of trading software, but different from Gecko, that this one did more zero-sum trading. This one did arbitrage. This was personal. I kept it to myself because of the fact that it did arbitrage, and it doesn't work if you do
exactly,
that with a bunch of people.
As you were saying earlier.
Yeah, so this one traded on Poloniex. And then it did like a triangular arbitrage. So it's like in Poloniex, you had all these different markets. If you have Tether, then you can use a Tether to buy Bitcoin. If you have Bitcoin, you can use that to buy ETH. And you could sell your ETH into Tether, which is like a triangle.
Got it.
In terms of how the money flows. And sometimes there's inefficiencies there. So you should actually do all of these things that I said, and you'll end up with more dollars.
Wow.
Very rarely, especially during a crash or something. Then something might just be like massively mispriced.
This is really funny to hear because I remember trading on Poloniex and they had Bitcoin pairs and USD pairs. And I remember thinking there's obviously has to be some opportunity here to do arbitrage, but never went any further than just thinking about it. This conversation is really making me feel like I probably should be more motivated when I think of these things. I always have this thing in my head when I look at something like that, I'll go, there probably is an opportunity there. It'd be pretty quick to verify it. You just pull some data and run the numbers, and then you can go and capitalize on it. But I always think in my head, someone's probably already figured that out and the opportunity's gone away. However, I'm guessing especially in the early days, there would have been quite a lot of money just lying on the table, right?
Well, I used to think the same thing, actually. I used to think, all the easy arbitrage is gone. And the easy tricks, like the free lunch, as this is called.
Yeah.
In finance, it doesn't really exist. Like, and when I was working on Poloniex, like I wasn't thinking, oh, this is the early days, right? I was like, I'm way too late to this party because people have been doing it on Cryptsy, which was at some point the leading alt exchange. And I remember there are even a few YouTube videos from back like 2014 and 2015 where people were describing the arbitrage. They did it earlier. So when I was working on the system in 2017. I know, okay, it was just before the big bull run, but I didn't know that at the time, of course. But yeah, I didn't think I was early. I thought I was late.
I've got a theory on why some of these opportunities are left on the table. So my thinking is that essentially there's like a counterparty risk being priced in here. Let's just say if you were to do arbitrage on BitMEX, for example, you're buying Bitcoin and selling the Bitcoin futures. So you're essentially flat in Bitcoin terms. You've got like a USD. Essentially, you're exposed to USD and you just earn the basis on the Bitcoin futures on BitMEX. And annualized, that gave you, say it gave you 20% theoretically in a year. Then my theory is something like the market is essentially pricing in saying that if you want to hold your Bitcoin on BitMEX for a year, the risk premium is 20%. And as an exchange becomes more reputable and people become more comfortable putting funds on the exchange to take advantage of these arbitrage opportunities, then that risk premium will fall down.
That's definitely, that plays a role. However, sometimes this premium, so the cash and carry arbitrage you describe, like sometimes the premium goes up and it really does not have to do with BitMEX suddenly becoming more risky.
Sure.
Right. There's huge pressures from traders who like to trade on very big leverage on BitMEX. And they can push the price out of bounds against the people coming into kind of cash and carry ARP debt. But the reason why, like, so in your example for cash and carry ARP, I very much agree that the risk The counterparty risk plays a very big factor. And that's solely because, one, it's like it's very easy to see this opportunity. You can just look at the price of the future and you look at the price of spot, right? You don't even have to actually like pull some data and run some calculations.
Right, right.
That's the first thing. And the second thing is that the most people who are engaged in this kind of trading are quite professional and they have very big balance sheets.
Mm.
So it doesn't take many people to, like you only need a few of those big people that all work at big trading firms to kind of, you know, like throw $100 million at this kind of problem. Maybe not 100 in crypto, but like, you know, throw a significant amount of millions of dollars at this to kind of counterbalance the price.
Yeah.
And that's different in like when I was working on Agent Smith, there weren't really like, there might've been a few other people doing similar things, but maybe, yeah, they stopped doing it or something, or yeah, it's a little bit harder because it's harder to see if it exists. Like you might never, for all we know, like, you know, other people tried it, but they had actually technical problems or something, or they were too slow.
Mm. I've never done any triangular arbitrage before. I used to do cash and carry because it's quite easy to do manually. Obviously, as you were saying before, you just see the opportunity and enter the position and you can unwind it manually as well. You don't have to write any code or anything. But I'm guessing for a triangular arbitrage, you're taking advantage of quite small price differences, but you're doing it quite quickly over and over again, or?
Yes.
Right.
So Agent Smith, because I always also already felt I was late to the party. So I was like, if I want to do this triangular arbitrage, it needs to be automated and it needs to be reasonably quick. Like the price mismatches are not that big that you can kind of like, you know, that it takes 5 minutes and you can just like click on all the different market tabs and then very quickly run some calculations. So my Agent Smith, so that project, like I started just as a hobby. Like I wasn't thinking by myself, this is going to be, you know, a cash cow. And I can retire from the money I will make with it. And honestly, it was just a fun project. And I was trying to figure out this arbitrage as an experiment. Because I had similar reservations as you back at the time. Like, I'm not really sure it's going to work. But I was just, you know, putting in some free time and just having fun. Because the alternative was actually day trading on Poloniex. And for me, that's a losing strategy. So, yeah. And this Agent Smith, at some point, I remember, I think I had like a few $100 deployed on Poloniex in all kinds of alts. And I was doing this triangular arbitrage. Yeah, and at some point, I was very proud because I was making $10 a day. And it was a very big, it made money every day.
Yeah.
I was able to make it very consistent that it like, it didn't really lose money.
So you do have the magic bot that just prints money.
I had to watch it though. Like I had to keep watching it.
Yeah,
So that's called like, that's finding alpha, right? Like as a quant or as a someone who writes trading software, you're always looking for like strange inefficiencies and strange patterns that you can exploit, but like they're never going to be there forever. So that piece of software I made back then, it's not working anymore. It only really worked up until like, you know, start of 2018. So just after the bubble, when the price started to go completely insane, the amount I was making with it went up from $10 a day to like very, very big amounts of money. Mm-hmm. And at the time I was working at a bank as a blockchain engineer. Then at the end of the year, I was like, well, I have this bot and it's making, just in the specific months of like November and December, when the price was really just going bonkers, I was making so much money with this little Agent Smith thing. And that's the kind of strange thing. Like, it's the same software. Or like, I mean, I was optimizing it, of course. It wasn't 100 times better than it was in like May or something when I had the same thing. Right. But it was making 100 times more. It's really strange.
Just to backtrack a little bit, we were talking a bit about why there's these market inefficiencies in crypto. And you mentioned that retail punters, especially on derivatives exchanges, they'll push the price up because they can access leverage. And I was just thinking, it was interesting how you said that towards the end of 2017, as the market became more chaotic, your bot started making more money. Now I wonder if there's more retail interest using leverage and liquidations going on and causing chaos than there are people like you writing arbitrage bots and trying to take advantage of it, then things become more chaotic.
Yes, this is exactly what's happening. And the more chaotic it gets, because there's not enough market makers and arbitrers to keep everything kind of in check, like keep all the prices kind of like reasonably in line with each other.
Mm.
Then things get out of whack. And the further they get out of whack, the more money you can make by bringing them in line again. So in this sense, it's very similar to like Bitcoin mining is like, it's a, as the Bitcoin price is going up from a Bitcoin mining perspective, like more and more people will get into this market and it will become very, very competitive and aggressive. But as more people get into it, like your hash rate as a part of the network goes down, so you start to make less again.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
And you see exactly the same behavior in markets. Like, so market makers, they are competing with each other. right? So it's not just that market makers are like, oh, when the prices go crazy, like, oh, they'll make so much money. They still have to compete with all each other. And they also have to have quiet times, right? Or there will be quiet times in the markets. And then usually they're still active because a bull run can come out of nowhere, right? And you don't really want to be like, when the market is quiet, I put all my money on the bank. And then when the market starts to go bonker, then I'll just, you know, start marketing and making again. That's not a very good strategy because you will get caught off guard. These dynamics kind of keep everything in line. So what you generally see is that if there's a whole lot of interest from retail, but also from, you know, other directional, like we're all waiting for the institutions to come, for the Wall Street to join crypto, right? Mm. I mean, this used to be a big big joke back in the day. Yeah. I'm not sure if we're still waiting for them or if they're funds. Already here. Exactly. Yeah, yeah. I mean, they also bring great flow, right? It doesn't like, it's just if someone just does a ticket of like, if someone goes to BitMEX and they do a $10 million market order, that's the same flow for a market maker, right? As long as it's just, I want people to trade big size, right? It doesn't really matter. Got it. How they do it.
Okay, yeah. So getting back on track with your story about, you know, how Folkvang came to be. Agent Smith became or stopped working in early 2018, you said?
Yes.
And so what was your next step after that?
So I still thought, oh, this Agent Smith is very cool, but you need a crazy market to make a good amount of money, and else it's kind of meh. So my attention shifted to Gecko Plus. But meanwhile, I always was. So Agent Smith originally worked on Poloniex. I did, like, for example, after that Poloniex started being less interesting in terms of an exchange, and then Binance started growing. So I did do stuff like I ported Agent Smith to Binance, and I had actually quite a lot of success there in the early early months of 2018.
Nice.
Doing the same thing, because they also had all the alt markets and everything. You could do the same triangular arbitrage. This is, by the way, when they had a fixed fee tier system. So it was very different. Yeah, you had just the BNB discount, I think, or mm-hmm. they introduced that at some point. But the fees were fixed for everyone. And that makes it easier to kind of try this stuff out.
Because no one has any advantage.
Yeah. Mm. Because on Binance, when I started early 2018, I felt again that I was late. Because the IPO was like mid 2017 or like late 2017 maybe.
Yeah.
But there were many people on there for months already and I wasn't, right? So I felt late. That's kind of how it goes.
Interesting. So at what point did you decide to move on from doing this kind of triangular arbitrage thing to trying new techniques?
This all naturally, I mean, I guess after Agent Smith and then the Binance version and a bunch of other versions, I slowly started getting into market making, but in a very simple way. Like if you look at the price chart, like sometimes you see like a fat finger flash where someone just did a very big market order. Yeah. They just ate into the book, right? And then it just bounces straight back up again. That's also something you can arbitrage by having your order in the book at the right time, right? Mm. Like a good way to do that is be a market maker, because then you always have orders in the book. Mm. So you always catch all of them. That was kind of the thinking. I started that, but I started with really simple stuff. So it was, again, a very simple piece of software managing a few hundred dollars in a kind of hobby capacity. And I guess at some point when I was working on Gecko Plus, I decided to stop that venture because I just wanted to trade myself. And this is at the same time when I was like, okay, I am now taking this serious and I'm doing it full time. But this is way before it was called Folkvang.
Yeah. Did you have a name at the time, or was just there was no need for a name?
No, not really.
No code names?
Well, systems. All my systems have code names. Yeah. Well, I used to put a lot of thinking in naming my strategies and naming my systems.
Yeah.
But recently at Folkvang, we've grown into quite a big scale. So like we have many of them now, and it's not uncommon for me to like create five new ones that are usually just like, I'm not talking five new complete trading bots from scratch, but like five new iterations or small differences, so to say. But five in a day or something is not strange. So right now we are that's one of the issues that we have, is like we can't name things fast enough and we're lacking good inspiration. But we used to put a lot of thinking in, like, you know, naming these naming everything. Yeah,
cool.
Yeah, so Gecko is named after the guy from the Wall Street movie,
of course,
Gordon Gecko.
Yeah.
And Agent Smith from The Matrix. I name a bunch of other... I have a few systems running that are inspired by like sci-fi names.
Mm.
Like Knight Rider, like the famous TV show from like the 80s. So Knight Rider, we got Blade Runner. We got, let me see, many, many systems like that. But nowadays, we're getting a little bit cheeky with naming things. Yeah, so just the other day, I looked up a very big page on like Wall Street algos from a company called Nanex. They investigate like flash crashes happening in, I think, mostly equity markets. Yeah, and he had this very big page with all kinds of graphs with little crazy algorithms. And then he gave a name to all of them. And I've been just using that as kind of like a list. So I've been copying it. So we got crop circles, we got Xanax, we got like all that kind of stuff.
Very good. And yeah. What's the story behind the name Folkvang?
Yeah, so in Nordic mythology, so this is the religion of the Vikings back in the day in Europe. According to them, if you die, you go to heaven. And then they have a bunch of different heavens. And one of these being Folkvang, which is if you are a warrior and you're on the battlefield and you die on the battlefield, which is the most glorious way to die.
Of course.
of course. Yeah, no argument there, right? Then you have a good odds of being selected by Freya, which is one of their gods, to go to Folkvang, which is one of the heavens. Like, so Valhalla is another heaven in their religion. It's a more famous one. You get picked and you can go to Folkvang, which is a heaven, which is basically a very big dining hall. And then you sit there and you eat and you
with
feast
all the warriors.
And you who passed away on the battlefields.
Very good. And what kind of market making techniques are you using now at Folkvang, and what platforms are you enjoying at the moment?
Right now, we are very much like also on the capital side, like we've definitely been growing. So we don't really have a lot of luxury anymore. Like there are a lot of smaller exchanges that I like and I know quite close with founders and everything. But it's very hard to allocate a lot of money. And then they're not, you know, because we need to make a profit as well in the P&L and, you know, to outstand the risk of putting money in places. So I'd say right now, like we're most active on like the biggest derivative exchanges. So like there are a few really big Chinese ones that are not really talked about much in the West, but they're actually huge. If you look at like a Huobi OKX, they're probably like the two of them might just be like the most dominant exchange in the space.
Do you think that all of the volume on OKX is real?
Okay, that's a good question. So there's probably some weird alt markets where I'm like, well, this looks super painted and this is probably all fake. But generally speaking, if you look at their big markets, like all the flow, like all the liquidity, you can hit it. All the flow is kind of there. I guess especially with Chinese exchange, they have a history of doing very low fees. I don't know. And so early in 2015 or 2016, you had a bunch of Chinese exchanges like OKCoin and BTC China that were doing zero fee trading, and their volumes were like 5 times bigger than all the Western exchanges.
Yeah, I remember.
But it was all wash trading.
Exactly.
And then they and I think they got slapped by some Chinese regulator that was like, no, you can't do that anymore, you need to charge fees on the trading. But now if you go back now again, we see again these fees going very, very low, close to zero.
My theory is that with the Chinese exchanges, I think even Bybit did this, to be honest, is when they start off, they fake volume, and then that attracts real people because they're like, oh, look at this exchange with so much volume, I'll try it out. And then as people actually come in and real volume actually comes in, they dial back the fake volume until eventually there's hardly any fake volume left. This is quite a clever way to go about things, even if you think it's unethical, because it seems to work. And then the other thing is, essentially, there's no clear point you can point at to go, that was when they were faking and that's when it became real, because it's like a smooth, gradual process. So then it's a lot harder to pinpoint when they become fully legitimate.
I mean, so first of all, like even in American startup culture, you have this very big saying like "fake it until you make it," right? I think in the whole growth hacking and
this is what to be honest, like this is where I switched in my mind, because I used to get quite annoyed at this. I got in an argument with, I think it was a community manager or some kind of marketing person for OKX, and she didn't say that OKX definitely did that, but she said even if they did, it wouldn't really be a problem because all startups growth hack. And I'd never really thought of it as growth hacking before, but maybe this is the future, I don't know.
I do have to say, like, I think it's bad as well from an ethical perspective if they're just straight up lying about, if they're like reporting printed trades that didn't happen.
Yeah,
it's very, very bad, I think. But it's like, it's very, like, where's the line? Like, at some point, like, many exchanges in a startup phase pay for liquidity. So they go out to, you have a bunch of market making firms specialized in working with smaller exchanges or like ICO teams.
Yeah.
This is also market making, but it's not what we do with Volkfang. But yeah, so where's the line? Like, so imagine they do that and then they go to another guy who can do arbitrage and they say, we give you zero fees.
Yeah.
And you can do some arbitrage if you want. Like, yeah, you're basically at a war strange scenario.
So
it's so thin line, right?
The question becomes, what is a real trade? What is real volume? I guess what I was trying to say before is I'm happy to acknowledge now that it's a lot more complicated than I first thought.
Yeah, it sounds very simple to just like shy it away. Oh, they're lying, so they're bad.
Yeah, I think as well.
If they're clearly like, if they're reporting trades like happening, like you know where the BBO never went, like where the order book never went.
Mm.
Like, yeah, okay. At some point, it's just straight up, like lying, right?
Right, right. If you're gonna fake volume, at least do it across the whole exchange, like from order book through to execution. Don't just like add it to your volume number at the end of the day or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't fake volume either. I'm not in the exchange business.
Right.
Like, I would personally like go for more an integer approach, right? You want to build trust towards your users. But if you look at the winning, like the biggest exchanges right now, they haven't really done it through gaining trust, right?
Mm.
That doesn't seem to be the best marketing strategy. Yeah, it's a strange world we live in, for sure.
You're quite close with the FTX guys. You did a podcast last week with them. And you took an investment from Alameda.
Alameda, yeah.
You know, those guys are super interesting. And obviously FTX was put out by a trading firm. Have you ever considered before that maybe in the long run you might be interested in starting an exchange yourself?
Yeah, right now I find it unlikely. Like, of course, you never know what's going to happen.
Mm.
But I mean, with Gecko Plus, my big lesson is that like I really do not want to be facing a lot of consumers that are very angry and you know,
sure,
want to give me their money to trade or for something else. So like, I can imagine seeing that as like, this doesn't sound fun. The compliance, the legal, I see many things that don't really spark my interest.
Right.
Like what I love about trading is that like, so I grew out of this very tiny, small code projects like Agent Smith and Gecko that I have some code, I push it live. And as a trader, like you can basically keep doing that, like as a trading firm, I don't really have to deal with anyone. Mm. I can, to some degree, I mean, I need to have a good relationship with for example, the investors behind us, but also to exchanges.
Yeah.
But generally speaking, we can kind of do whatever we want this way. And I really, really like that. And an exchange, I think, yeah, you've seen that growth a lot before. I think even if you look at BitMEX, right? Like, I think Arthur was also a big trader.
Yeah.
So not a trading firm, but he was doing, he used to work at a bank before that, but he was doing a lot of like ARP, I think, right? Between Chinese exchanges.
Yeah, he was a market maker. Oh, and
yeah,
then,
and if
so
you look
he,
at...
So he started as a market maker in the traditional finance space and then was doing arbitrage between Hong Kong and China before starting BitMEX.
Yeah, you see that a lot. You see that. So if you look at Deribit, for example, it was founded by two brothers, and John, CTO of Deribit currently. So he was an option trader. I'm not sure what kind of degree, but like you see, and he was like, I'm an option trader. I want to trade options for Bitcoin, but there's no exchange.
Yeah.
So I'll create one.
Yeah.
And you see that with many exchanges, right? Yeah. So now you see it with FTX, right? Which is, but it's coming out of like actually professional crypto traders, if you can call it that.
Yeah. Right.
Which is a little bit different, but it's not unique in that sense. But yeah, there's definitely like, you know, in terms of the integrity I was talking about, like people have concerns about FTX and then Alameda being a very big trader on FTX, of course. Mm. And yeah, I guess their strategy here is to just, you know, keep running and just prove the whole world that they're they can have a great exchange. That's
right,
fair.
Right. I think obviously the best way to fix reputational problems is just to have a good track record over a long period of time. And then these things go away. You know, you earn the trust.
Yeah.
One thing I always found interesting going into crypto was there's like a clear divide in the space between exchanges that are someone who has a trading background and you know, essentially start a startup and try to build a tech platform. And then there's some other exchanges which are tech people trying to do finance.
Yeah, I think I agree. Product is also very, and I think you definitely see this in the blockchain space a lot more, which is almost completely run by developers or like many parts about it.
Mm.
And it's definitely in terms of usability and in terms of creating products that everyone loves, it's always hard, right? Like for example, with Bitcoin, you got now the Lightning Network, right, which is a solution for the scaling issues. And that's, it's a very typical, like, it's super elegant from an engineering perspective. It's like, we can do everything super secure off-chain, and we only have to settle if there's a dispute. And it's like, it's honestly, like, it's very, very elegant from that perspective.
Right.
But then when it comes about, but it turns out to be a not very usable consumer application, because, if you want to use Lightning, you need to stay online, and, you know, you need to have these channels, and it's very hard to get them, and it's like... So you got all these practical problems, but the raw engineering is very, not just the engineering, but the math as well behind it is so, very, very nice.
So
yeah.
what do you think of DeFi? That's something I've never spoken to you about, actually.
Yeah, very interesting. I'm watching that space like very, very closely. I do have to say, so like as a market maker, at some point I touched upon DeFi market making. But this is like back in 2018 when you had a few DEXs that were big, like Delta, I think, Delta.exchange or Order Book or something. I can't actually remember which one. So I did that, but then the big promise was like, okay, after all these exchanges are getting hacked and everything, we just need to have a decentralized one, and then all the consumers will flock to them. We didn't see that back then. But now there's like a whole new wave of DeFi coming out, right?
So with the current global market situation, it looks like there's going to be low interest rates for a long time now, which essentially means that savers in the real world are going to be penalized for probably the next 2 years at least. One of the things I find really interesting about DeFi platforms are these lending markets where you can earn 5 to 8% per annum on US dollars, essentially. It's got me thinking about how potentially... I know saying the killer app is a little bit cringe, but essentially the killer app of crypto could be in fixed income. Essentially, people who are looking for pretty ordinary yield, as in it will probably be provided naturally by the market if we didn't have this massive intervention from central banks that artificially suppress interest rates. Then the question becomes whether stablecoins do that job well enough. You know, like say I'm in a country, my local currency is going to shit, or say I'm in a developed country, and I can't get any interest on my US dollars or euros, but I can get a stable coin and get 5 to 8% a year. That's pretty cool. Then why would I go into the DeFi space and start using DeFi tools rather than just using a stable coin?
I do think this comes back to the argument that you also made earlier. Like, there is counterparty risk. I'm not sure if you can call it counterparty when it's DeFi. It's more like systemic risk, I guess.
Yeah.
That's definitely a worry. Like, we have seen it gone wrong, right? Like with Maker, for example, after the big Bitcoin crash in March, they had many, many issues around liquidations. I think at some point, I don't really know how it works, but at some point they had an auction where they were auctioning off like liquidated assets or something.
Yeah,
but there were always no buyers, and it was a little bit of a chaos.
It's a good point. I think when they say, you know, the great thing about blockchain platforms is you don't have to trust any middleman. You know, there's no centralized party that's the risk. And I'm like, no, the platform is the central party. If you're relying on an Ethereum contract to power this whole financial system, then that becomes the thing that can break.
Yeah, I agree very much. Like, there can be very, very big things that we haven't really seen and that are going to be a very big impact. But like, if specifically, if you look at ETH, like it had an issue. Like, at some point there was a very big DeFi project called the DAO.
Yeah, yeah.
And it turned out there was a bug. And someone was able to steal a whole lot of money from very prominent ETH community members.
Yes.
And everyone else. And then they were like, okay, we're just going to fork the whole chain, right? And so we're going to make a new version, or we're going to do a hard fork.
Exactly.
We're going to introduce this rule. Basically, like, the hacker doesn't have the money anymore that he just stole.
Yeah, that was really interesting, because that kind of proves my point about the platform becoming the central party. Because if the platform decides to go and fork itself, this is how Ethereum Classic spun out and everything. Ideologically, yes. I kind of agree with what they were saying, which is that tough luck, the system should go on. At the same time, I go like, it was early on in the project. Maybe it was okay to do it then, but it's not okay to do it now. But the principle has been kind of broken now, because say, for example, Bitcoin has an amazing run over the rest of this year or going into next year, and then we get another kind of Ethereum boom that usually happens when Bitcoin rallies hard, and the DeFi space is the new ICO craze. So rather than people doing ICOs, everyone's doing all this DeFi stuff. And then once again, you have too much money pumped into the system and Ethereum falls over. Do you do another hard fork then? That's the question that hangs over Ethereum's head now. The problem was that I think the amount of Ethereum that was stolen in the DAO hack was so much that if you kept the chain going on forever, the damage would have been probably so great that the project would have really struggled to stay alive. So maybe they did make the right call and the project is a lot healthier thanks to that hardcore.
Yeah, the big argument that I heard was that after the DAO hack, like, yes, a lot of money, a substantial part of all ETH. Yeah, I'm not sure what the percentage was, but it was a lot at the time. I remember about being about $300 million worth of ETH. And insane. This is when ETH was very cheap.
Yeah.
So the big argument I heard was that, like, there were a lot of regulators and there were a lot of were looking at this. And they had crypto, right? With all the terrorist financing and the money laundering and all the, they have all that stuff back in their head. And then this happens.
Right.
And so what I heard is that there were many, many people, because the DAO project was very much endorsed by the Ethereum Foundation and a lot of people very close to, like, you know, Vitalik.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Vitalik himself as well, he was very much endorsing this project. And what I heard is that there were many, many people there, and they, I'm not sure if they actually spoke to regulators or what happened, or, you know, like some investigator somewhere. I don't really know what happened, but I thought that the risk was substantial that a lot of people would end up in jail over this.
Mm.
And they were like, and after that, that's going to be the end of, like, the crypto. I'm not sure if this is true, right? Like, for all I know, this is just some conspiracy theory I heard somewhere.
I've never heard that before. But to be honest, it wouldn't surprise me. It was a substantial amount of money, and the DAO really attracted a lot of retail people. Bitcoin's attracted a lot of everyday people as well, but I think Bitcoin has done it over a long period of time, and there's been exchange hacks, sure. Maybe apart from Mt. Gox, there hasn't been any single event that's impacted like a massive percentage of the ecosystem in the way the DAO hack did. So I think as a regulator, the DAO hack is a lot easier to be like, these Ethereum guys need to do something. So that kind of makes sense. I wouldn't be surprised if it was true.
Yeah, exactly. It's exactly as you say. Like, Ethereum was at the time quite young. This was one of the first ISO projects on Ethereum, if I remember correct.
And
so everything was kind of young, and all the people were, like, very much public.
Yeah.
Like, it's so different from Bitcoin, right? Where, like, in Bitcoin, this couldn't happen, like, because no one could ever agree on to do such a thing, which is why we have all these hard forks, right?
Yeah.
Because people can't agree and Satoshi is gone. So, yeah, what are you going to do?
Right.
But with ETH, it's just like, you know, Vitalik holds the strings.
The Bitcoin hard fork that resulted in Bitcoin Cash, that was necessary to upgrade the protocol, but it was still, you know, very controversial. Do you think that some of the kind of ethical questions about decentralization that the Ethereum hard fork raised have also been raised in Bitcoin?
So all in all, a very similar situation, because you have two camps, right? Like, within Ethereum, there were also many people that were like, this is not a good idea because code is law. That was the slogan of the Ethereum project back then, or from the DAO, I can't remember.
Yeah.
Code is law, and then they're just going to change it. It really goes against it. So there were many people against it at the time. But Ethereum was just, in terms of, like, you know, who led the project and the politics there, was a lot more centralized, as well as the fact that, like, so the Ethereum team and the foundation were very close to all the big exchanges at the time. That's where most retail actually interacts with these things, right?
Mm.
Up until we actually have a lot of DeFi. They were super quickly to contact all the exchanges, and they even did all of this in secret as well, like, before it publicly came out. When Vitalik announced on the blog that they were going to fork, like, all the exchanges already knew, and they were already working on the. So it really wasn't decentralized in any way, shape, or form, right? Whereas with Bitcoin Cash and Bitcoin, it's more like a circus show, and it's more like how I guess I like it and how it should be in a decentralized system.
Yeah, that's definitely true. But I wonder if that was only because Bitcoin is older. I got a really sad Ethereum story, personal Ethereum story. I bought into Ethereum in early 2016. Because one of my best friends was an Ethereum nut and he was learning how to code Solidity. He was super, super into it, talked about it to me every day and convinced me to pretty much go all in Ethereum. Like, I pushed all my Bitcoin in at one stage at like 70 cents or something like that. I was like on Twitter annoying people all day, shilling Ethereum. I was on the ETHTrader subreddit. I even created like a joke Ethereum DAO myself called Hemicity. I was so into Ethereum. I really loved the idea of decentralized autonomous organizations. But with the DAO, I got really disillusioned because I was following it very closely. And I just thought the project was going to become a victim of its own success because it was too much money was coming in too fast. I remember them saying, this is pretty much a test thing. Don't put too much money into this because we're not sure if
it's
going to
work. I remember that too, actually. Yeah.
And then there was this whole debate about whether to have a cap on the amount of money that could come in. But then people were saying, if you put a cap on it, you could just fork it and start a new one with no cap. And that, so you can't stop people buying in. So they just went, all right, there's going to be no cap. And the next minute, it was like hundreds of millions of dollars, right? It was obscene. And I sold all of my Ethereum slightly before that, actually, and went full reverse. I started to become a Bitcoin maximalist. I was on Twitter like saying Ethereum's going to implode and everything. And so
you're kind of right at some point. I mean, it didn't implode, but...
So the problem was, man, I was right in the sense that DAO collapses. Like, I didn't call exactly how it would happen, but I had a feeling that it was going to be a catastrophe, that there'd be some issue. I can't remember the name. One of the DAO guys, like, he used to look kind of nerdy, and then like he suddenly had like slicked back hair and was like dressing up really fancy all the time. There's just all that kind of telltale, this is about to go bad type stuff happening. Yeah, I think the highest price I sold my Ethereum at was like $2 something. To this day, I have never bought Ethereum ever again. So I just swore it off. I was like, DAO hack happened. I was right. Ethereum's a scam. It'll just... you know, it'll fade into oblivion. Nice idea, but technically not feasible. And then obviously Ethereum blew up. And yeah, I really regret, actually, especially now that I'm seeing the DeFi stuff and it's very high quality, it actually works. Though part of me does wonder if, you know, if there is a big uptake in interest in DeFi projects, will the gas price suddenly skyrocket again? Will Ethereum like fall over?
I have many of the concerns you had, I still have as well. Like, I see a few issues with ETH as well. Like, so they're working on a new version, right? It's going to be completely different. And they're going to allow you to convert your ETH into ETH 2.0 at some point via some kind of a peg. But, like, so, yeah, I don't know. Have you synced, like, you were playing around with ETH. Did you, like, ever, like, sync nodes and stuff like that?
Well, I didn't ever do anything like that. I mean, I bought a lot of Ethereum, and no joke, back then they were already talking about staking. So me and my friends were accumulating ETH because we wanted to stake. Back in 2016, we were waiting for Vitalik to announce any day that staking was, you know, just a few months away. That was also another reason I became disillusioned, because that was postponed.
I have played around with, quite a few years back for me now, but like the full blockchain of ETH is terabytes, and there are not many people that have it. So they do it a little bit differently than like Bitcoin node software, but it's like, it's massive, it's clogged. It's because they made it so easy for everyday developers, including me at the time, to start making, decentralized applications using Solidity, which is a very approachable and accessible language. So yeah, everyone and their mom played on, like, you know, played and put something live, and it's still there, right? Like you can destroy if you make a contract in Solidity, you can destroy it again, being like a good like netizen to like clean your shit up when you're done. But yeah, most people don't, or they don't know how to do it, because they made it so easy to develop and to deploy, and which is also the upside, which is why it became so popular so quickly, right? So it's good as well. But right now we're like, you know, like the ICOs, like we had them in 2018, they're dead. They're not there anymore. But all their shit is still on the Ethereum blockchain, right? It's never going away up until they move to the ETH 2.0.
It's a graveyard, a decentralized projects graveyard.
Yeah. It's terabytes. I don't know the current size. I think a year ago it was around 3 terabytes. With Bitcoin, the standard mode is that it downloads all the blockchain history, which I think for Bitcoin is around maybe half a tera at this stage. But Bitcoin is a lot older, of course. But then you can run a Bitcoin mode, a node pruned. This means that like all the old stuff that is not relevant anymore, that we can throw it away, and then it's a little bit slicker. Yeah. But the default mode is that you store everything. And with ETH, it's very hard to actually store everything, because they have these warp modes and these, basically everything is pruned. Standard. I'm pretty sure. So as such, it feels a little bit like they're trying to hide the fact that, like, you know, it's a little bit messy, and they really need to get on to ETH 2.0.
I don't want to keep bashing on Ethereum here, but the DAO started off as an experiment. It was clearly labeled as such. It's like, don't put too much money in this, we're just trying something. It blew up, and then everyone just kind of switches and goes, essentially it's like greed. So greed comes into the equation, and people prioritize like making money rather than making good decisions about the tech from a technology point of view. I'm not saying that there aren't greedy people in Bitcoin. Of course there's greedy people in Bitcoin, but I think a lot of the people who work on the protocol itself, the core developers, people who really understand how it works and provide the basic infrastructure, I think they've been a lot more resilient to greed factors than other projects have been. And that's one of the reasons why Bitcoin has stood the test of time.
Agreed. I very much agreed there. Yeah. But there are some downsides to that approach as well. But in terms of stability and in terms of not being persuaded and corrupted, you see that a whole lot more in Bitcoin for sure.
But one other problem I think that goes unsaid, Vitalik is kind of like the god of Ethereum. And I do worry that one day if he wakes up and goes, actually, I don't want to spend my whole entire life working on this project. I want to do other things, which is like a normal thing people do. You know, you only live once. You don't want to just work on one thing your whole life. I wonder if Vitalik announced, hey, I'm going to be moving away from this project. I'm not sure I want to keep working on it full time anymore. I'm kind of curious what would happen. I've got a feeling that there would be a mass exodus just from people who own Ethereum and like who own it because of the personality cult around Vitalik.
Agreed. From a price perspective, it would probably be bad. But from a project perspective, long term, you know, after Satoshi left, there was also a lot of uncertainty and people didn't really know. And there's still massive concerns about Satoshi coins, right?
Mm.
Like just a few weeks ago, some really old coins moved and people thought they were Satoshis. And then
yeah.
Price crash, $1,000. Yeah. So I'm not sure if it's going to turn out like that, but the current Ethereum, like how it's currently working, why people like it and how they appreciate it, it's definitely because of the like celebrity status of Vitalik, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if that disappears, then we need to see different things. And it will probably be like wars within factions about who's going to take over, and there will be forks, right? Like that stuff always happens after a power surge, basically, right? It's like when a dictator is toppled in a way. Like I'm not...
Maybe.
Like, being negative about Vitalik here, but...
Maybe.
But I mean, you don't know what's going to come out of that, right? Like, so just to go back a little bit into, like, how we were comparing Bitcoin and Ethereum.
Mm.
Yeah, so I have a few things I don't like about Ethereum, and I said a bunch of them. But still, I think, like, it's a very cool project. I don't consider myself either a Bitcoin maximalist or an Ethereum maximalist or something else. I think they're separate projects with different goals. What makes Bitcoin good is the thing that it doesn't actually change much. Like you can send money around, like you can send money abroad, works great. We're very slowly working on some like layer two stuff, but generally speaking, like nothing has really changed since SegWit, which wasn't even that big of a change when you think about it.
Yeah.
But with ETH, they're pushing hard, and in that way, like they're innovating at a lot faster pace. And yeah, they make mistakes and things go wrong and things break and they have to hard fork the chain again. So and that is not decentralized at all. Like in the future, I'm pretty sure like the kind of DeFi that we will later use, like I'm very crypto bullish. I'm pretty sure like almost all of it is inspired by stuff that happened in ETH DeFi.
Mm.
And not because nothing is really happening in Bitcoin DeFi, right? So it's kind of like it's good for the hodlers because there's nothing ever an event and then the price crashes because, you know, something broke in Bitcoin. But in terms of, you know, like, are we actually going to get anywhere? I think Vitalik is kind of like the Elon Musk, right?
Yeah.
In that sense, like he's going to get us to Mars. With his ideas. I'm not saying that ETH 2.0 will be the Mars spacecraft.
Yeah, I think that's definitely a fair way of putting it, to give him some more credit. I wonder, though, if Vitalik steps down, will Craig Wright try to make it, try to take over Ethereum?
Yeah, he'll be claiming that he was Vitalik all along, yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I think Craig Wright is he's an interesting character. I think he goes very much in line with politics nowadays worldwide, right? Like these strategies work. And you can even see, like, I don't really want to bash on exchanges and everything, but there are definitely a few exchanges that made some interesting choices recently that I think are very much like, this is actually Craig Wright kind of style. And also with Twitter's new decision where they're like, you can create common threads that like only your followers can like, only people that you follow can come and interact with. You get these kind of really weird fake news silos.
Yeah.
It's weird.
Yeah, it's kind of a side topic, but I found that feature interesting. Like, I'm not really sure why they thought that was a good idea or whether the benefits of that outweigh the downsides, because I think even CZ from Binance has changed his, so now that only people who follow him.
Yes, he's a very big one there, yeah.
I mean, I don't really like that. I think the great thing about Twitter is that anyone can get in the discussion. Obviously, there's problems with spam and abuse. Like, no one's denying that. But I'm not sure that this was the right solution.
I agree. But from like a business perspective, like Twitter has always kind of been lagging behind Facebook, right? And like so the way Facebook works is that their algorithms kind of make these little, they call filter bubbles, right? Which is like on Facebook, you're much more likely to see stuff that like you have a very big emotional reaction to, that stuff that you don't care about, right? So like even though you're befriended on Facebook with your uncle, if you just post shit that you don't care about, you don't see it, right? You only see stuff that you really care a lot about. And I'm pretty sure like this move from Twitter will create similar dynamics, that you'll just have like more like isolated groups. And this is going to boost, like just from a business perspective, I think this is going to boost engagement on Twitter. You're going to get the, you know, yeah, at the end of the day, like, you know, it's a company and they want to make as much money as possible. And this utopia of Twitter where everything is free and open. Yeah, from a business perspective, it didn't make a lot of sense. I mean, I prefer Twitter over other social media, but
yeah, I actually don't. Most people don't. I actually don't have Facebook.
I mean, neither. Not anymore. I just know that the stock price is very high, right? It's a, it's a valued company.
Yeah. Understood. I'm quite a big user of Twitter, but I definitely have to make sure I don't use it too much because the fact that you can see all sides can make you feel a bit anxious, especially when this interesting world events going on, like just so much information and conflicting ideas and people getting angry at each other. I'm not sure how much of that is a platform problem and how much of that is a social problem. As in, if society is actually becoming more divided and people are actually becoming more angry at each other, then I think social media platforms should actually reflect that. So at least we know what's actually going on in the world. But that being said, social media shows a world that's a lot more divided than it actually is. Because if you turn off your computer and go for a walk down the street and say hello to people, everything's fine. Or like in most of the time, maybe not in America at the moment, but in most of the world, that's usually the case. And you'll probably be able to reach a consensus and befriend people much more easily in the real world than over Twitter, for sure.
Yeah, and as social media is getting a bigger impact on our lives, I definitely think, like, you know, we see this divide, like, trickling in the real world. And you're seeing that in the US right now with a lot of social tension.
Yeah.
But, I don't know if you're, like, so the Arab Spring, you had that right around a decade ago, I think, at this stage in Egypt. Right? I think social media and like, new technology is very, very powerful in a society. It can play a very big role.
Yeah.
And I think right now we're seeing the ugly stuff we're seeing, like we're seeing it more on social media, but it's leaking in. And we see it in politics as well, right? It's leaking in into how people think about other people that think differently or pray differently.
It's a good point. I've had an interesting experience recently where one of my best friends, actually, he joined Twitter recently. We're very good friends in real life, but we come from very different backgrounds. Oh, not extremely different, but in practical matters, we tend to take opposite sides on political matters. And we'll talk about these things in real life and have really great discussions because we find it quite easy to find the common ground and empathize with each other to understand where we're coming from. And that's quite a good experience because then you can understand why people have different views and how they're not malicious, essentially. That being said, though, whenever I see his tweets, I get really angry. And then we start arguing on Twitter, and it's really strange because in real life, we argue, but I never feel bad after it. It's like enjoyable. But when I argue with him on Twitter, it feels really bad. And eventually I just stop and then like message him on like WhatsApp or something and say, hey, let's catch up sometime and chat about that next time rather than tweeting about it because it's silly. But now that I think about that, maybe that is like a microcosm of what's happening on a social level. Essentially, maybe these platforms actually bring out a bad side of us, or without the context of, you know, if you're arguing with someone face to face, you get a lot more feedback and you're a lot more careful about how you speak, and you can't be rude and you're not forced to be short like you are on Twitter.
So, yeah.
Yeah. But then I think for a lot of young people, maybe if most of their experiences are through social media, then when they come out into the world, maybe the way they're going to behave is a bit ugly.
Yeah, for sure. I think this is a great example, by the way, and I can very much resonate with it as well. I recognize a lot of what you said. Yeah, very much. And I think there are a few reasons for it. Like, one, you can't really read the emotion, right? Like, you don't get the same amount of feedback. But the other thing on Twitter is that, like, everything you're saying, like, everyone that kind of likes you is kind of standing behind you and watching what you say, right?
Yeah.
So I think there's a few sources of influence. They don't make they don't get the best out of us, right? Like in terms of,
well, it becomes mob behavior. That's never a good thing. We're really going on a side thing here, but I think this is quite interesting. Have you heard of the idea called mimetic contagion? There's a French philosopher called René Girard, and he had a theory that essentially human beings naturally imitate each other, right? Like if you see a child and they like you, they'll start imitating what you do. Or if you're like dating, the imitation is the greatest form of flattery. Like we naturally look at what people do and copy them if we like them. And René Girard's theory is that if we have mimetic desire. We imitate what other people desire. So, you know, that person has fancy car, I want fancy car. That person has nice house, I want nice house. That person wears those clothes, I want to wear those clothes. Then as long as the economy is growing and the amount of resources available is growing, then there'll be peace because everyone can get what they want, essentially. And we can all imitate each other. As long as there's enough stuff, it's all cool. But
yeah,
if the economy doesn't grow fast enough or there's a sudden shortage of goods, the desires don't go away. We all still want the same things, but there might not be enough stuff. And that's how we get mimetic conflict. We start fighting with each other. Yeah, René Girard's theory is that essentially this simple... It doesn't explain everything, but it explains a lot of human culture and how we regulate relationships and society. It's all about essentially containing the potential of mimetic conflict getting out of control. If that makes sense, then one thing I really worry about is that with social media and the, you know, internet essentially allows all of us to be looking at the same stuff all day. And what that could do is, on a global level, we all focus our desires so that we all desire the same thing. And that means that the surface for conflict is bigger than ever before. Because before social media, you know, I might live in a small town and I mostly just know the people in my town. So the things that I desire in my town are going to be different from another city or another country or another group of people. So the potential for conflict to kind of spiral out of control until there's like massive fights everywhere is quite small. But if we're all thinking about the same stuff every day and we're all focused on the same events and the same desires, then I think there's a lot more risk for social breakdown than before.
Oh, for sure. I think it's I wasn't familiar with the theory, but it's very scary for sure. And if you combine that with like how we've turned into consumers a whole lot more over the last like century or so.
Exactly, yeah.
Because we didn't always used to be like this, right? Even forgetting about the internet and forgetting about like, how well connected we all are now. As far as I understand, like a few hundred years ago, we didn't really have the need to want all kind of stuff that we actually didn't need, right? Like we didn't, yeah. there was no desire, except for like maybe some rich people, but like, you know, the everyday people, they didn't want to buy fancy cars.
If you go with that theory, essentially, the idea there is that in the past, the way we regulated this conflict risk is we said that we just kind of taught each other to get over it. Not everyone can be the king. Not everyone gets to live in the richest suburb. Work with the hand of cards you're dealt with. And socially, there's like a lot of pressure essentially not to be too materialistic. But then since World War II, we figured out how to mass produce things. So now we don't have to tell people that anymore. Now we tell people, go out and get what you want. Go out and get a loan. If you can't afford it, don't worry. Just go out and borrow money. Get what you need. And we just have this mass consumer culture. And we have to make sure that the economy is constantly growing. Because if it doesn't, then those desires desires don't go away. And then there's conflict.
Yeah, exactly. And I think so, a big shift that we saw like around the war, I think a lot of it has to do with like Freud as well, right? Like when they were trying to like basically reshape the economy into a very big consumption economy, where like you need people to buy stuff to keep the whole thing going, as you were saying, right? It didn't used to be like that, I think.
No.
And then if you combine it with everything else that we're seeing, right? So in the US, it's very much a credit-based economy, right? Like you build credit, right? So if you're financially healthy, that means that you borrowed a lot of money and you paid it all back, right? So I come from Europe where that's very strange. Like you're financially very healthy if you don't borrow money.
Right.
Like maybe you get a mortgage for a house, but like that's it. You wouldn't get a loan for a car. Because it means you're financially not healthy because you don't have the money to buy it. So in the US and in many, many other cultures, I think it's also gaining a lot of traction in China as well, actually, like other big growing economies. Like they're much more credit-based now. So if you combine that on top of the consumerism and then and now on top of a lot of economic uncertainty, because of, if you look at finance itself, like people keep over-leveraging, right? Like you see this on BitMEX as well as you see it on Wall Street, right? Yeah. With the big banks doing the same thing because they can get nice bonuses that way. And if they lose, they get a bailout from tax money.
Yeah, there's no downside.
So yeah,
if you
add all of that together... Yeah, and then you add all that together and you come back to Twitter with like the newest edition, which makes it even more siloed, right? So if you just follow a bunch of people, like only what they say is what you can actually read, right? You can't even read their people that argue against it as a comment, because that's not allowed anymore. if people enable that. Yeah, you get into this very scary world for sure. I'm worried.
There's an interesting relationship between optimism in society and credit, I think, that has become problematic. So I think the reason why that there was a switch to a credit-based economy after World War II is that people were so optimistic about the future that they were comfortable taking out big loans and such because they were so confident of the of there being strong economic growth and the future being better than the present. So if you go and borrow a heap of money and do stuff now, it'll be okay to repay. But now we're addicted to the credit and the loans, and we still have this constant optimism about things continuously getting better. But I think actually, if you look at the hard data and the real economy, real measurements of freedom and prosperity, especially in developed countries, I think things are slowing down, but we haven't really realized it yet. There's still a lot of empty optimistic promises, but not a lot of actual delivery, especially for younger people who might have only ever experienced relative stagnation compared to what happened in the last century. That being said, of course, if you really zoom out, times have almost never been better times have never been better in many different ways of looking at it. But I think in some ways it's maybe made us a little bit lazy. I was talking to a guy who runs a stock fund recently. He'd run the fund for a number of decades, and we got in an argument about what it meant to be long stocks, because he said to me, if you're long stocks, you're long human progress and prosperity. And I laughed, and he was really kind of shocked. I said, I just don't see it like that. I said, maybe that was true in the last century, up until like the 80s or something. But if you're long stocks now, like especially big stocks, what you're long is the status quo, is in your long big business, squeezing out smaller companies essentially, and maintaining the status quo, which has some really problematic trends, like inequality is getting worse, the environment's getting really destroyed. So there's all these problems with the status quo. So if you're long the status quo, maybe that's not a good idea anymore. Coming back to crypto, I guess, I think what a lot of people are looking for is they do want to invest capital. They like the idea of capital. They like the idea of trading. They like the idea of using money efficiently and actual progress, like actually building things that are new. Of course, crypto hasn't delivered on all these promises and we still have a long way to go, but stocks and the status quo definitely don't seem to be working properly anymore.
Yeah, I agree. I do say like there are many different companies, so there's many different stocks. But yeah, if you look at the S&P, I think especially like I saw this chart recently where you saw like, you know, the S&P is made out of the 500 biggest companies. But I think like more than half of the S&P is just the top five, which is like, you know, Microsoft, Apple, Facebook, Amazon and Google, I think.
Yeah.
Those are like I don't think if you just the market cap of those five is like half of the S&P or something, right?
Yeah.
It's like, yeah. So I 100% agree with your arguments a lot more. Mm. Like if we want to see like drastic change, which I think is needed, like we need a kind of new paradigm, so to say. That said, like traditionally when I came into crypto, I was very much like, you know, I think the current financial system is pretty much skewed towards like the 1% and the rich. If you look at inflation, if you look at the investment opportunities that rich people have composed as opposed to people that are not very rich, right? Like with accredited investors and all that kind of stuff. Mm. But now I'm thinking, well, I still think that's true. I still think the barrier of entry in crypto is very low. And I still think we're seeing innovation, and most people who are in crypto actually like, you know, want positive like societal change.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, I think if you look at the technology and if you look at the what, like Bitcoin in a lot of ways is a whole lot more, it's the most purest form of capitalism you can get.
Mm.
Right? If you look at like so mining, for example, you can go as far as the, you know, like stealing mining equipment and I mean, okay, that may be a stretch, but like, or sabotaging other, like there's nothing that can be kind of done about that, right? Like if you're a mining farm and you did something really bad to another mining farm, like you own those Bitcoin, and there's literally no one that can ever kind of. So I see some dark sides as well there in terms of like it might actually make things worse.
I definitely agree with you that there's like a pure capitalistic element to it. And if you suppress free markets and free trade, people will naturally find ways to do it. For example, in countries where there aren't free like free local markets, you have black markets. So in a way, Bitcoin is the infrastructure for free money, non-centrally regulated money, because some people have a natural desire for that. Historically, they got it with gold, I think. But then it isn't a perfect system, obviously. Pure capitalism, even if there was such a thing, isn't necessarily a perfect system. But Bitcoin, as some kind of implementation of a capitalist ideal, is not perfect either. For example, if you want to move away from the traditional financial system because of the extremely high wealth inequality that's in that system at the moment, Bitcoin has tremendous wealth inequality, and it will have even more if a lot of people move into it. People like us essentially would become the new 1%, the new incumbents. And there's nothing about Bitcoin that makes us more likely to efficiently allocate that capital in the best interests of society or anything like that, more so than the US dollar or something like that. In fact,
yeah,
there's probably less mechanisms in Bitcoin to have that happen, whereas with the US dollar system, there's more ways to fix it potentially because it's not hard set.
Yeah, exactly. And this is so, yeah, I agree. Like, it can be very scary in that sense. Bitcoin is really like, it's just because basically when you think about a blockchain, it's kind of like it's an isolated kind of system with at the middle of the blockchain, there's like a courthouse where decisions are made, where disputes are resolved. But it's run completely by, you know, like computers without any emotions or any opinions, not caring about anyone in particular. It's so raw, right? In that sense. It's just in terms of if you want to battle inequality, I'm really not sure if you should be looking at Bitcoin.
Yeah, see, I think a lot of people, they expect too much from an economic system. In my opinion, that an economic system's job is to make sure that resources are allocated efficiently and fairly and justly, in the sense that, you know, people have the freedom to allocate them, have a relatively higher level of autonomy, but there isn't injustices, as in, you know, you don't want one person having all the stuff. But when it comes to morality and how people decide to use their economic freedom, that is not something that you should bake into the system, in my opinion. That's a social issue. So if you have a problem in society where you have mass wealth inequality and you have people hoarding wealth and not putting it to work in any way, then that's a moral issue, not an economic issue. And the way you fix that is by, ideally you live in a society where people care about each other. And if they have good fortune enough to come across a lot of wealth, or they accumulate a lot of resources, that they have a genuine interest in looking out for people in their community. But I don't think you need to hard bake that into an economic system. So my take is that a lot of, especially young people who feel very disenfranchised, I think they often go and start hacking away at an economic system, and they want a hard set in rules to reroute money and do what, like regular wealth redistribution and whatever. But I think actually you should attack it on a social level. And in that sense, protesting and stuff, as long as it's peaceful, is a good idea, because it signals to people who might have neglected their social responsibilities, like, hey, we're here and we need you to be more responsible, I guess.
Yeah, for sure. And I think so, in the real world, even if you look at the current economic situation and inequality, like, political change can happen. If everyone is poor and they all vote for some change there, like, there will be change, because, like, especially in, so voting and democracies are still very dominant in the West, right? So, like, yeah, as long as you got enough people that care about it and vote a specific way.
As long as the state apparatus, I guess, hasn't become completely corrupted. So in some countries, there's some issues with lobbying and essentially corrupt officials, either willingly or unwillingly. Like, maybe they're just honestly stupid. They don't understand how they're not carrying out their duty. But you could have a system where essentially, even if you win an election, the apparatus just isn't able to deliver good outcomes, or those people become corrupted when they're put in a state capital, for example. So you might be like a great community leader, and then you get elected and go to the capital of your country, and you're just surrounded by people who give you terrible information and advice, and then you become kind of corrupted by that system. I don't think it's like a one-stroke wonder, but there's cause to be optimistic about the system we already have and just making sure that it works the way it should, rather than throwing the whole thing out the window and, for example, transitioning to a world where everyone works by DAOs like tomorrow. I think in the future things will become more voluntary, but I think for now, liberal democracy is not a bad idea.
Well, I think I'm just like I mean there are arguments to be made for many sides, and I also agree like it's very very hard to have some kind of a political candidate who gets elected to then actually like does the things that he promised, because it's his position changes, but not what he thinks, but like in terms of who he has to deal with and how we and his priority changes, right? Because his priority goes from I want to be elected to I want to stay in office, right? Which is a very different problem usually. So you see a way he needs to attract different kind of key holders or different interest groups, lobbies that have existed. He needs to right for all kinds of reasons. Yeah, it's super hard for sure. Without going into whether we need that or whether we need something else. Like with Bitcoin, it's kind of like we're pushing all of these potentially very important decisions into this decentralized, autonomous, computerized layer. That can be even scarier. Like there's nothing you can really change there, right? Especially if you get it if you get Bitcoin into like in a global in the world kind of status where countries don't really agree about the protocol changes anymore and the thing gets kind of locked in. Like there's like and then it's kind of like there's nothing that can be changed anymore. We kind of have to live with this thing for as long as the whole world kind of uses
this,
right?
It's the same issue some countries have if their constitution is overly explicit. And then they lock in ideas that were maybe relevant 200, 300 years ago, but aren't so applicable now. I definitely see that as a problem. And it doesn't even have to take that long. Actually, the DAO is kind of an example of this. Remember, they had problems where they couldn't really update the code properly after they found bugs. So it might not even need to take a year or something. It can take months for a system to become too popular for its own good. This has been an amazing discussion. We've gone way off topic, but I think this has been super interesting anyway. To kind of wrap things up, I'd like to ask one last question, a bit of a personal question, actually. In the previous ZoomerJD interview, I spoke to Hazu, researcher from Deribit Insights, and he was talking a little bit about how he'd been researching some stuff about the history of religions and seeing some similarities in the way people become obsessed with coins and almost become religious in the way they talk about their given coin and they'll defend it to the death almost. Obviously, you're someone who's had your life almost kind of hijacked by crypto in a way. Do you think that you'll stay in crypto or do you think in the long run you might end up moving into other areas? Like, is this something you think about often?
It is. And for now, I definitely have zero plans of going anywhere else. Like, crypto is my passion. So now it's trading. Before this, it was more blockchain development. So I also did a lot of Solidity stuff.
That's
this
cool.
kind of stuff is my passion. I don't see it changing. But I also think that we're in this transitionary phase with DeFi or even just computerized finance. I don't think that the space is going to look like how it did, like how it does right now. It's not going to look like this in a few years. And we've all already seen this, right? Like you touched upon this earlier, where many people in the crypto space have gone very greedy. Also because of the amounts of money that are now at play. And so, if I think back about like a few years ago, I thought I was going to stay in this field forever. But now the field has changed. And so right now it's a lot more greedy than it was back then. If it's going to get even more greedy, then I might jump ship at some point. But so it's kind of hard to say where we'll go because I don't think we're going to stay in this space for very long. We're going to see some adoption, I think. We're not, right? We're still in the building phase.
Yeah, that's a really interesting way to look at it. That essentially the scene might transition you into a new thing that is like the future of crypto, but it's so different. It's as good as working on a different thing. Sometimes I take a break from crypto with the intention of potentially leaving, and I always come back because it can maintain your interest for so long because it's constantly evolving. There's so many different parts to it, and I think nothing else can give you the same level of constant information and fascination as crypto can, or a few other things can, as far as I know.
Exactly. I have exactly the same feeling because it touches upon so many things at the same time, right? Like it's an experiment on many levels because before this, I was getting really deep in development and in the programming, you also have a bunch of religions almost about which programming language to use or which framework to use. And like, I always lost interest in those because there was one level to them, right? There was one kind of side to debate. All debates were the same because always about the same thing. Whereas with crypto, it's so multi-dynamic, right? That's what I really love about it. But yeah, it's so hard to say like how it will look in the future. But yeah, so if I get tired of trading, I can go into DeFi or I can go into I could get into like online elections or blockchain elections or like, so many things that are not really related to trading and even money at all, if you want to, while staying in crypto. And that's the beauty. And me as a developer, it's all driven by software, right? So it's very approachable for me. You can always peek behind the curtain, which is always on you on GitHub. So it's like, yeah, I don't see myself leaving in any way. But
awesome.
We'll see what the future holds.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for your time. We've only done two so far, but this is keeping the quality very high, I think. People are going to really love this interview. Thank you so much for your time, man.
Awesome. Yeah, thanks for having me. Yeah, I really enjoyed it. Thanks.